This week on The Score, what happens if the United States raises import taxes on Mexican goods? How are Americans protected against double jeopardy? Have the Virginia Attorney General's views on marijuana law changed? All this and more on The Score, so don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. This week we pick up where we left off last week with our conversation with two Young Voices contributors, Sam Peek and Rachel Tripp. We had a wide-ranging chat about immigration policy, tariffs, and President Trump's visit to Europe, among other things. Let's listen.
We're just going to have a sort of a freewheeling discussion about what's going on in the world. And let's start with the threat of tariffs against Mexico to persuade the Mexicans to do something more on immigration. Sam, let's start with you. What's going on with that? Is it really going to happen?
I don't know if it will or if it won't happen. President Trump has made a lot of these same threats before, and he's backed down on them, just like he did with closing the border. But if he does, it's going to be really disastrous for both the U.S. and the Mexican economy, and it will likely exacerbate the migrant crisis.
And there's some opposition to this proposal foaming up in Congress right now, especially on the Senate side. There may be some kind of resolution passed against it. Do you know anything about that?
I think that there's a growing understanding that if we are to implement tariffs against Mexico in an attempt to help them, you know, force a decision around the border, really what it's going to be doing is punishing our own consumers and our own capitalists who are trying to turn a profit, or consumers who are trying to purchase goods in a way that they can afford. I think that our legislators are recognizing that and hoping to push the president in a different direction.
What has Mexico been doing with regard to the migrant crisis that is falling short? Are they willfully not acting to prevent more migration from Central America?
Well, I think that there is probably an argument that can be made that Mexico can do more. They have cut a lot of funding to their own processing agencies. But at the same time, though, the Trump administration expects them to absorb all of these asylum seekers, and the United States government can't even do that, and we have so much more resources than they do. And a tariff will close them off from resources, it'll worsen the economy, and it will make it even harder for the Mexican government to absorb these people.
And there was the announcement this week that the Trump administration is cutting funding for the children who are being held in detainment camps at the border. No more English lessons, no more soccer playing, no more lawyers helping them. And, of course, there have been numerous instances of toddlers showing up at an immigration hearing with no legal assistance and having to defend themselves against government lawyers. Rachel, what do you think of that situation?
Of course, there obviously has to always be an approach of compassion, particularly when it comes to minors. At the same time, I understand that there's an attempt here to encourage the Mexican government to take responsibility for what are essentially their own nationals. I think that ideally responsibility has to fall not only to the United States government to treat them humanely and keep them safe, well-housed, and fed while they're on our property or within our borders, but also on the Mexican government to recognize that there is a responsibility on their end to help bring them back to their own country of origin, since President Trump has made it very clear that he is not willing to absorb them here.
And there have been some proposals in Congress to increase funding for immigration courts to help alleviate the backlog. Do you think there's any chance of that legislation passing and getting to the president's desk for his signature, either one of you?
I'm not optimistic about it, given the gridlock in Congress right now, and I'm not optimistic that President Trump will sign it. But You know, in spite of that, I would like to see a bipartisan push for that. We need it. We need a system that exerts our values and recognizes the rights, the international right of asylum seekers to claim asylum.
Yeah, and that's something that a lot of people are mixed up about. You know, some people think that these are just kids or families who are crossing the border illegally, but a lot of them are using the international standards to ask for asylum. There's a difference between the two categories, but certainly as far as asylum seekers go, we need to respect international treaties. Isn't that true?
I think that there is a challenging approach to this because there are so many people who are claiming asylum and many people who are claiming that they're also coming to the United States to seek a better life. Obviously, the United States was built on immigrants coming to seek a better life, but as we have evolved as a society, there have been laws that have been put in place to help them come into our country legally, help them join into our system of social security and taxation legally, and those who are seeking asylum, it's very hard to determine whether or not that is a legitimate claim. I think that coming from a country where it is not maybe as comfortable as the United States, or there aren't as many economic opportunities, does not necessarily qualify as a legitimate, recognizable claim to asylum.
And when you think about it, a lot of these immigrants from Latin America, south of Mexico, even living in Mexico is an improvement for what they have. Mexico is a middle-income country, industrializing, and this is one of the problems with the tariffs, because you know we've got the supply lines between Mexico and the United States and Canada in the automotive industry, for instance, that would be disrupted by adding import taxes to auto parts, for instance.
So this is a comment that I've made on the record before, and it is that particularly when the caravan was moving up from Central America, South America, coming up through the continent, if they were genuinely seeking immediate physical safety or immediate reprieve from an overarching government or oppressive conditions, there were many opportunities for them to stop on their journey and find themselves, as you just mentioned, in a much safer, cleaner environment where they do have an opportunity to prosper. If the United States was their long-term goal, they also would even be an opportunity to find short-term work, find ways to come through the system legally, and by not doing so, they're proving that, at least in my mind, asylum is not their immediate claim, or that personal safety is not their foremost goal. It's really to enter the United States, which I completely respect, but only if they're willing to do so legally.
And if I understand the way asylum is supposed to work in the international system, a refugee is supposed to ask for asylum in the first country that they reach in which they can find safety. Is that right, Sam?
So if you have, say, a safer country agreement with the country, and we do not have that with Mexico because Mexico has not demonstrated that that they're not going to comply with the international law of non-refoulement, which means that you turn people away without processing their asylum claim first. We don't have agreement with them, and so that's why they are able to legally claim asylum in the United States. Back to the point about people who are crossing between ports of entry illegally, you can see that the Trump administration has exacerbated that quite a bit. You have the union chief of border patrols claim as such, and you have DHS interviews with people with border patrol agents claiming as such too. It's metering where he's blocking people unnecessarily from entering through the ports legally. And what they're doing is they'll re-enter three times or four times, and then they'll cross through in between ports, and then they get prosecuted as entering illegally.
Is the Trump administration policy of threatening tariffs a way of pushing Mexico to honor some of these international agreements that already exist but they're not participating in, to get a treaty between the United States and Mexico dealing with these issues? I know the Mexican foreign minister was in Washington, I think today, talking to Vice President Pence. Is this something that's on their talking points?
I'm not sure. I know that the problem with this is that if you're going to negotiate something, you have to make sure that you're willing to go through with that. And Trump has even proposed extending the tariff to 25% within the course of time.
Yeah, I think October 1st would be the deadline for raising it to 25%.
And the United States economy, especially in Rust Belt areas like Michigan, which 10% of their imports rely on Mexican goods, it's going to devastate a lot of those areas.
It's almost as if President Trump is trying to scuttle NAFTA 2.0, the USMCA. Do you think he has something nefarious in mind?
I think that President Trump is someone who prides himself on his ability to act as a businessman, make deals that he believes are profitable, and I think in this instance, make deals that are going to be beneficial, in his mind, to the United States. I think that he does have the good of the country in mind, not necessarily some underhanded or nefarious agenda, but I do think, again, that the approach to tariffs or trying to force an agreement through tariffs, while also maybe having some of those diplomatic meetings like you just mentioned with Vice President Pence or whoever else, is not necessarily the best way to move forward, since it's not really helping the immigrants in question or the American people.
Let's segue a bit. President Trump is on a diplomatic mission right now. He's overseas for the D-Day ceremonies at a state banquet with Queen Elizabeth in London. How do you assess his visit to the UK, Ireland, and France?
So considering going off of our discussion of diplomacy here, I think that any opportunity for us to have a positive and friendly interaction with our allies is always a good idea, always a positive move for international relations and diplomacy for the United States. Obviously, the United Kingdom, Great Britain, and the United States have always had that special relationship, and I like to see this administration furthering that with a queen who obviously has also had her own opportunity to further that relationship with many presidents in the past. From what I've seen, this has been an overall very positive visit both the United States and the UK, although obviously there have been the typical protests that we would expect when a foreign leader visits any country.
And just as an aside, Queen Elizabeth is 93 years old. I've never seen a more vigorous nonagenarian. I mean, when she speaks with authority and grace, and it's amazing. She's dealt with every president of the United States since Truman. Longer than most of us can ever even hope to live. There was another question I wanted to ask. Seems to be some confusion about U.S. policy towards Libya right now, and you know something about that. What can you tell us?
So I think when it comes to the way that we treat our allies internationally, again, as I just mentioned, it's always very important that we maintain as many diplomatic relations as possible, but we have to put the safety of our own American people first. With the civil war that's happening in Libya, obviously it's awful to see the violence that citizens are dealing with. Civilians are dealing with a very challenging coup, essentially, on a regime that for a long time has been in power. And when we consider whether or not the United States should interact with that war, should get involved, I really think that it's their civil war, it's their problem to deal with, essentially, and I would not like to see our own American troops being sent over into a situation of violence and danger when really the Libyan regime and the Libyan system of governance is not a threat to us as it stands, or with the potential gaining of power of this new regime as well.
Yeah, there was a specific instance last month, or maybe it was in April, when Secretary of State Mike Pompeo issued a statement in support of the Libyan government, the provisional government, I guess it is, in Tripoli. And a couple days later, President Trump had a phone conversation with a rebel leader, Haftar, and essentially endorsed him. Is there a disconnect in U.S. foreign policy making?
I think that there has been several instances where Pompeo and President Trump may have viewed international relations or issues of foreign affairs differently. I think that we've seen that with the recent potential conflict in Iran as well, where Pompeo is much more willing to involve American troops in that conflict in Iran. And President Trump, I think, has said on the record many times that he wants to have a new approach to the Middle East that does not mirror the one that we've had in the past, which has been very interventionist, very hawkish. And I don't believe that President Trump wants to further that tradition of involving our troops in conflicts that are not necessarily a threat to the United States, a threat to our economy, and certainly not worth endangering our own servicemen and women.
Just to wrap things up, we've been talking about immigration, we've been talking about tariffs, foreign policy in general, but on the immigration issue, I'd like to get each of you to assess whether there will be some kind of, I won't call it comprehensive, but significant legislation dealing with immigration issues between now and the election in November 2020. Sam, do you have any ideas about that?
You know, with Trump, it's unpredictable, but I'm not optimistic that we're going to get the politically polarizing issues like DACA through anytime soon. I think that if we're going to look at immigration reform, we have to see it through smaller parts of overall larger bills, you know, like more legal protections for people who served in the military, immigrants who served in the military, liberalizing health, you know, foreign workers and industries like healthcare. But I don't see an actual immigration reform bill actually passing.
And Rachel, what do you think?
I think that the answer might be a little bit different were we not heading into an election year. I think that this is an issue that the Democrats are certainly going to try to bring to light. They're going to make it a election year issue. But I don't believe, particularly with the gridlock that we've been seeing with this Congress and this administration, that there will be any particularly new or revolutionary legislation passed this year. I would like to see our legislators taking a long, hard look at our immigration system and considering what a best solution is to protect our illegal immigrants, our citizens, and also to ensure that there is a path for, again, law-abiding immigrants to come into this country and contribute to an economy that does rely on their contributions.
Young Voices is a great organization, and I'm glad that you're participating in it. Are either of you working on articles that may be published in the next couple weeks, regardless of what the topic is?
I feel like I'm always working on something. I've been following the Democratic 2020 candidates, and as the news unfolds, so does my writing, recently published on Mayor de Blasio's candidacy announcement in New York City. As an East Coaster, I'll be following all of the news from all of the candidates that are coming from the Northeast region, and I will be sure to keep you updated as that goes on.
And Sam, do you have anything coming up?
Yeah, I'm writing about our need to bring in more foreign healthcare workers to the United States. There's a lot of bills in Congress right now that aren't getting enough coverage, and one is likely to pass, too.
Okay, well, that's an interesting topic. It's sort of an immigration issue in miniature, but it affects our whole healthcare system. Well, I'd like to thank you both for joining me today, and welcome to the Score. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Although the United States seems to have reached an agreement with Mexico on immigration controls, there is still the specter of future tariffs on Mexican goods entering our economy. I spoke to Simon Lester, a trade policy analyst at the Cato Institute in Washington, and asked him what the ramifications of higher import taxes on goods from Mexico would be. He said there's a simple answer and a more complex answer.
The simple answer is if you put a tax on all imports from Mexico, it's going to raise the price of all the goods we buy from Mexico. And you know, 5% is not enormous, but it is something, and it's scheduled to increase over time. So June 10th will be 5%, July 1st will be 10%, August 1st, 15%, and it'll go up to 20 to 25% and just stay there. So that would mean a 25% tax on all the things we buy from Mexico. So that's a wide range of things. There are a lot of cars and trucks involved. There's oil. There are avocados. There are TVs. There are computers. And so consumers who buy these products will see those price increases directly. At the same time, businesses who buy parts from Mexico and use them to make finished goods here in the United States will see their costs go up. And so either their profits will go down or they'll pass along those price increases to consumers. Now, one complicating factor, though, is that this could have an impact on the Mexican peso, Mexico's currency. It could throw the Mexican economy into recession, cause the peso to decline, and so we could see some of the price increase mitigated by that. So it's hard to say exactly how much these tariffs will affect U.S. prices. There are a lot of things that will be going on at once, but it's sure to have some effect on imports, and it's also likely to have an effect on U.S. exports to Mexico. Mexico will probably retaliate with its own tariffs if their currency falls. That will also lead to a rise in prices of U.S. products sold in Mexico. So you're going to see on the import side price increases and then lost U.S. sales by U.S. producers to Mexico. So the combined effect on both economies could be pretty substantial.
Let's dive a little deeper because your mention of the effect on the value of the peso is the first I've heard this. So could you explain why the value of the peso would be affected by the imposition of U.S. tariffs?
Yeah, I mean, so I qualify by saying I'm a lawyer, not an economist. It's something I've also read, but haven't sort of explored the details of. I mean, I think there's several reasons why that could be the case. I mean, first of all, just as I said, if there's a general sort of a downturn in the Mexican economy, that's something that could lead the currency to depreciate. But also, as Mexican producers, you know, sort of desperate to sell to the United States, I mean, I think there's just current currencies. All market prices are somewhat affected by psychology, people's beliefs in where economies are going. What I think will happen is that people buying and selling pesos versus dollars will sort of factor this into how much they value each currency, and so by losing confidence in the ability of Mexicans to sell to the United States, they will value the Mexican peso less, and that will sort of cause it becomes sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, if everybody's panicking about the market, stock prices fall just because they're falling, just because everyone thinks they're going to fall. And I think you'll see something similar here.
There seems to be a groundswell of opposition to these new tariffs in Congress. Where do you think that might go?
I think that for the most part, Congress has been reluctant to step in to push back against Trump's various proposed tariffs. But on this one, I think because of the nature, the egregiousness of the proposal, I think that you might actually see enough support here to do something about it. So what would have to happen is you'd have to have a vote, both houses of Congress. So you need a majority to overturn the president's decision, but you need more than that because the president could then veto the congressional action. So you really need a two-thirds majority. So you need a lot. You need a lot of votes. You need some Republicans who are willing to go against Trump. And so in the Senate, we've seen some prominent, you know, Republicans come out and say, hey, you know, we object to this really strongly, and sort of hinting that they would vote against it. In the House, you know, the Democrats control the House, but they would still need Republican votes to get to the two-thirds. Haven't heard a lot from the Republican members of the House yet. So I think it's still difficult to get up to the two-thirds majority you need to overturn a presidential veto. But there have been enough Republican members of Congress who are upset about this. They've been able to live with some of Trump's tariffs, but they think this one's going too far. So I think it's possible that Congress could actually push back here.
Do you think in the long term Congress may pass a law to withdraw the president's authority to impose tariffs unilaterally without congressional approval?
I think that if we get enough actions like this one, where the president just goes so far that everyone considers it outrageous, then yes, there are a number of bills out there that have been proposed to rein in some of the president's powers to impose tariffs, and every little thing that the president does to push the boundaries gives a little more momentum to getting some of these bills actually sort of passed through Congress. But again, you know, you need a two-thirds majority. I mean, it's not going to be easy. So yeah, if the president goes too far, the further the president goes, the more likely it is that Congress pushes back either behind the scenes or through new legislation.
Are there other examples from history of tariff policy being used for leverage on another issue, in this case immigration, but it could be some other diplomatic dispute?
It's a great question. Off the top of my head, you know, it's hard to think of something that's so disconnected like this. I mean, usually the tariffs are, you know, to some extent about economics. Now, look, if you're at war with somebody, you might have an embargo, and that's perfectly understandable. I mean, you don't want to be trading with somebody that you're fighting with. You don't want to give them access to things they might need. But in a sort of non-military, context, just to say, we are going to use these tariffs to bully you into doing what we want. To some extent, I would say you see it with, so for example, there's something called a program for developing countries where we give them lower tariffs to help them out because they're poor. But as a condition to getting those lower tariffs, they might have to protect intellectual property or improve labor conditions. So, you know, you can see ties between tariffs and unrelated policies. I think it's more a question of degree. This one just goes further. It's just more blunt and in your face. And it's a tariff. Instead of withdrawing a tariff preference, it's a tariff penalty. So you know, it's not completely unprecedented. There are similar examples you can point to. I would say this one just goes much further. And, you know, it's sort of tied to another policy that's so controversial, immigration, that it sort of, you know, builds it up into this, you know, much bigger deal. Whereas, you know, the other examples, I mean, no one's ever heard of these examples. This is one that's making headlines. So.
Just to wrap things up, do you think that this current dispute with Mexico is going to jeopardize NAFTA 2.0, the USMCA agreement that is now waiting for approval by Congress and the Mexican Congress as well?
It seems to me that if the Trump administration goes ahead with these tariffs and keeps them in place, I mean, if they go ahead for a couple days and withdraw them, maybe that's another thing, but if they actually go ahead and leave them in place, then yes, that would make it really difficult for the Mexican Congress to ratify the USMCA. What's the point of a trade agreement if the other side's going to impose tariffs? The trade agreement says, hey, we won't have tariffs. If you're going to impose them anyway, there's no point in signing it. So I think that's something the Trump administration has to take into account. If they want the USMCA, they may need to rethink the tariffs. They probably can't have both. So I think that is a reason why I think we might see these Mexican tariffs walked back. You know, we've already seen hints from senior White House people like Peter Navarro saying, well, they might not take effect. So I feel like this is something that Trump announced. You know, he wanted it out there as a threat, but he may, the grown-ups in the room may be able to talk him back from this one. Whereas others, I thought, you know, these are going forward. There's nothing we can do. This one, I think there's a good chance that this will be pulled back.
Just as a follow-up, how will this affect our trade relationship with Canada?
You know, I haven't seen anything about Canada related to this. I mean, if the new USMCA doesn't get approved, I mean, our relationship with Canada depends on what happens next. Is NAFTA still in place? Because if so, Canada's probably fine with it all. If this means we're withdrawing from NAFTA, then it really upsets that relationship. But yeah, Canada has not, as I've heard, weighed in on this. I think, you know, everyone's trying to keep their heads down. If it's not a tariff threat against them, they're just going to stand aside. So yeah, so it basically depends on what are the implications of this for the USMCA and for the original NAFTA.
This past week, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a ruling in the case of Gamble versus the United States on the subject of double jeopardy. The court decided against Mr. Gamble, but last September, before we knew what the court would say, I spoke with Elliot Harding, a Charlottesville attorney who wrote a brief in the case. I asked him to explain what double jeopardy is and what the case was about. From September 2018, here's Elliot Harding.
I think most Americans, if they heard the term double jeopardy, they would think that's the answer to the question, what is the second half of jeopardy? But there's more to it than that. Can you explain what the concept of double jeopardy is in terms of U.S. constitutional law?
Sure. So it's a pretty fundamental doctrine and predates the United States. It's the approach to individual rights that says you cannot be subjected to punishment twice for the same crime. You cannot be subjected to multiple trials after one has been concluded. And then finally, you can't be subjected to two different criminal codes that incorporate the same conduct. So it's recognized in the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution. It's been incorporated in the states in the 14th Amendment of the Constitution as well.
We're talking with Elliot Harding, who's a Charlottesville attorney, and you recently assisted the Rutherford Institute in writing a friend of the court brief in a case going to the U.S. Supreme Court called Gamble versus United States. First, how did you become acquainted with this case and become interested in working on it? And second, just tell me briefly, what are the facts in the case?
Okay, so yeah, Gamble against the United States is a case that's going to be heard this fall in the 2018 term of the Supreme Court. And it came across my radar just because the underlying issue at hand is something that I've been personally focused on for probably going on 5 years now, back when I was in law school. And what it deals with is the dual sovereignty doctrine. And that doctrine is a theory that says when someone commits a crime, they've done it against the particular sovereign or the government that has criminalized it. That includes the state or federal government, meaning if you commit a federal crime, the federal government has the right to prosecute you. If you commit the same conduct and it's a state crime, then the state gets to prosecute you. Both sovereigns get the chance to prosecute and punish violations against their sovereignty. Now, with that being said, the underlying facts of Gamble, you had a Mr. Gamble. I don't know his prior criminal history, but I do know that he was a felon in Alabama, I believe, who was eventually served his time for an underlying felony. He was out. He was free. And he got stopped, I believe, for a headlight being out. And during the stop, the officers found that he had a pistol in the car, and a felon cannot own a firearm. So in Alabama, he was convicted of a state crime for being a felon in possession of a firearm. And then after he was convicted, and I think he was sentenced to about a one-year term, then the federal government then successfully and successively punished him for
the federal violation of being a felon in possession of a firearm. So the same facts led to two different convictions and two different punishments. Ultimately, I think he was exposed to up to over 4 years of punishment, of sentencing for incarceration for the same crime.
That seems like black letter law. The Constitution says you can't be prosecuted for the same crime twice, and yet the federal government is prosecuting somebody for the same crime twice.
Right.
How do they justify that?
So it's actually something that has never been undone. This has been with us since the founding of the United States with this dual sovereignty doctrine, and that is prior to the 14th Amendment, it was understood that the Bill of Rights did not apply to the states. They applied to the federal government alone. Of course, every state has their own constitution. The Commonwealth of Virginia has most, if not all, of the Bill of Rights in its own constitution, so we're generally protected, as we always have been, but the jurisprudence of the Fifth Amendment in this case was never applied to the states. Then after the 14th Amendment was passed, through the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, most legal scholars would recognize that as the states willingly subjecting themselves to federal constitutional standards for the Bill of Rights, obviously, because the 13th, 14th, and 15th were passed around the same time. We had a bad history of the states having abhorrent civil rights violations for so long that the states recognized in the 14th Amendment we need to all play by the same rules when it comes to civil rights. And so from the 1860s until the 1960s, the U.S. Supreme Court incrementally recognized various aspects of the Bill of Rights to be incorporated to the states via the 14th Amendment. In 1967, the U.S. Supreme Court finally recognized in Benton against Maryland that the Double Jeopardy Clause of the Fifth Amendment is incorporated to all of the states. So prior to 1969, prior to Benton, a state wouldn't violate the U.S. Constitution's Fifth Amendment by prosecuting you twice. They might violate their own Constitution's Double Jeopardy Clause, but they didn't violate the Fifth Amendment's. So now we're in a point, since 1969 up until now, where the same Fifth Amendment protection from Double Jeopardy has applied to the federal and states, state government. And now we finally have a clean case, Gamble against the United States, that is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to say, all right, if this Double Jeopardy Clause applies to both the state and federal government, shouldn't the dual sovereignty doctrine be struck down for the purposes of the Double Jeopardy? Shouldn't we finally be in a position where the federal or the state, in either order, can't prosecute someone simultaneously or successively for the same crime?
A lot of people may not know what it means to submit an amicus brief in a court case like this. You work with the Rutherford Institute to create the brief. What's the purpose of it, and what's the process of submitting it?
So an amicus brief it's a friend of the court brief. That's what it kind of stands for. And what it means, or what the purpose it's meant to serve, is to provide an extra perspective to the court from a different interest of the parties actually involved. So in this case, you have defense attorneys or appellate attorneys for Mr. Gamble. You have attorneys for the United States. Those are the parties involved. But multiple different scholars or attorneys or interest nonprofit groups have submitted briefs to the court saying, here are additional points the court should look at in its decision. And so in this case, we provided a brief. I reached out to the Rutherford Institute, and we worked together on it to say, here's some extra points that the court should consider in addition to what Mr. Gamble's attorneys have provided. And Mr. Gamble's attorneys wrote a beautiful brief. It's about 72 pages, and it outlines a vast majority of the arguments to be made. And so we just tried to provide just a few extra supplemental components for the court to consider and that were a little different than the doctrine that the petitioners set out for. But by no means is the amicus brief by itself a complete brief. It's just, hey, Justice, maybe you should look at this as well while you're making your decision.
In the last 45 seconds or so that we've got left, the people who are defending the state of the law as it exists now, what is the rationale that they are using to argue against your point of view?
So the rationale of the dual sovereignty doctrine is to say states have their own police powers. They're their own sovereign. It's a basic federalism concept that the state is a different government than the federal government. And their argument will be that it is a violation of the federal government's sovereignty and the federal government's laws that are very different and have they come from an enumerated powers. They serve different interests than the states. They're promulgated by different legislative bodies. They should have the independent power to adjudicate crimes against their own sovereignty, and they should not be bound by what a state does or does not do, and vice versa. And so they're asking to be able to maintain their independent sovereignty to legislate and adjudicate from the states. But the big kicker here is the 14th Amendment and the incorporation doctrine.
Also in the news this week, Virginia Attorney General Mark Herring announced he was going to seek legislation to decriminalize marijuana use and possession. This differs from his position in the recent past, as you will hear in this interview with him from September 2014, just 5 years ago. Before we talked about drug law reform, I asked him about how he had changed his mind on marriage equality. Since June is traditionally Gay Pride Month, both parts of this conversation from the archives are relevant today. Here's Mark Herring from the archives in 2014.
Back in 2006, when you were in the state senate, you voted in favor of the Marshall Newman Amendment. Why did you vote for it then, and what changed your mind since then?
You know, after the vote, I saw how it hurt a lot of people, and that made me continue to question whether that was the right decision. I talked to a lot of people, people at work, constituents, my family, and I see things very differently now. Now, at the time I was working, back in 2006, I was working to end discrimination, but I stopped short of full marriage equality, and I came to see that that was wrong, and a lot of people were hurt by it, and equality is a bedrock principle of American jurisprudence. Nobody deserves to be discriminated against. And our Constitution guarantees not only gay and lesbian couples equality, it guarantees all Americans equality.
The Supreme Court is meeting on September 29th to consider the cert petitions. Do you think that the Virginia case is going to go all the way to the Supreme Court?
Well, the Oklahoma, Utah, and Virginia cases are all now before the Supreme Court on petitions for appeal. Those petitions have been fully briefed as to whether the cases should be taken by the court. Whether it's Virginia's case or whether it's, you know, one of the others or a group of them, it's difficult to predict. They are meeting later this month at what they call their long conference to begin to take up the cases, the petitions that have been filed so far. I feel confident that the court will consider whether to take one or some or all of these cases. Virginia's case would resolve a couple of legal issues right now. First, there was a couple of probably 30 years that has lived together, and a loving committed couple down in Norfolk. They were denied a marriage license, so it would resolve that question. There's also a couple who was lawfully married in California and adopted a child. They now live in Virginia, and Virginia is not recognizing that marriage and not recognizing fully that adoption. So Virginia's case would address all of those legal issues. I also think it would be good for Virginia. Not only do I feel we have a really strong legal team, but the Commonwealth, I know and we know, has moved forward since the key landmark civil rights decisions over the last 50 years, where Virginia was on the wrong side. In Brown versus Board of Education, people forget that was actually five cases. One of them was from Prince Edward County, Virginia. And Virginia and its attorney general argued against school desegregation and on the wrong side. In Loving versus Virginia, a couple from Caroline County was denied a marriage license because they were of different races. And again, Virginia argued on the wrong side of that key landmark decision. And then as recently as 1996, in the VMI case, Virginia argued against gender equality in higher education. And while it is Virginia's ban that is the subject of the case, I know, and we know, Virginia's moved forward since then, and because I've taken the position I have in the case, when we look at this issue in the future, people all around the country and our children will know that Virginia was on the right side of history and the right side of law. And as Attorney General, I was going to make sure that the injustices in those other landmark civil rights cases would not be repeated this time.
Speaking of being on the wrong side of history, an international commission is taking a report to the United Nations that says that drug laws should be reconsidered around the world, that drugs should be legalized or at least decriminalized. Currently, illicit drugs should be legalized or decriminalized, and it should be treated as a health problem. What do you think of that, that proposal?
As Attorney General, one of the first things I did in coming to office was go on a public safety tour all across the Commonwealth. I talked to over 60 different jurisdictions, the law enforcement, Commonwealth's attorneys, local elected officials, because I wanted to hear directly from them about the public safety threats that they were facing. Over and over in those meetings, one of the things I heard was the problems associated with opiate addiction, prescription drug addiction, and a spike in heroin overdoses and deaths and fatalities. I think that as Attorney General, I want to go after those who would put that kind of poison, that potent, deadly heroin out on the streets, and I'm going to aggressively prosecute that and work with local prosecutors to do it. We're going to step up our prevention and education efforts, and we're going to partner with the jurisdictions, local jurisdictions, and the U.S. Attorney's Office to combat the problem of drug abuse.
So you're saying you would not support drug law reform?
I have not seen the report that you're talking about, but I don't support legalizing all of those dangerous drugs like heroin and opiates that are killing and claiming so many lives of young people.
What about marijuana?
Yeah, I need to.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to be evasive. I know a couple of states have begun to take those steps, and before Virginia takes those steps, I think we ought to see what the experience is in the other states and then assess it.
And that's the same thing your predecessor said.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Nice to see you again.
The Supreme Court was busy this week. It also ruled that Virginia's legislative districts were designed improperly and pushed back against an effort by Republicans in the House of Delegates to restore their original districts from 2011. As it happens, in 2010, I had an opportunity to ask an expert in legislative redistricting about how Virginia would put its districts together after that year's census. At the time, Michael McDonald taught political science at George Mason University. I spoke to him in August 2010. From the archives, here's Michael McDonald.
I'll throw you a softball question. Next year, for the first time in Virginia history, redistricting is going to be done when both houses are controlled by different parties. How do you think that's going to play out?
How it's played out in other states is that one chamber will draw its districts, the other chamber will draw its districts, and then the two will do a log roll, and you will have both chambers verify the other, pass the other chamber's districts, and you will have two different partisan gerrymanders, one for each chamber. The wrinkle that we have in Virginia, though, is that the governor can amend legislation, and so there's a little bit of concern on the Democratic side whether or not if they, even if the House passed their version of the Senate plan, if the governor would still keep his hands off of it. So there's that question. The other thing that's going to maybe happen, and there's some talk about this, is that the governor governor is may form a commission or a committee of some sort to help assist him in evaluating the redistricting plans that comes out of the legislature. And so that may be a new wrinkle as well, especially if we have this divided government situation and the governor has to actually play a role here, a mediating role. Maybe that commission may play some sort of mediating role there.
Do you think it's realistic to expect that a redistricting plan will be made and approved by the time of the elections next year?
Plenty of other states have done it. We've done it in the past in Virginia. So presumptively, yes. The answer should be yes, that we can do it in time. If it is not done in time, though, it will be done. I mean, that's one thing that the voters of Virginia can know to be true, is that the federal courts will step in if the state government can't produce a redistricting plan, and they will basically draw their own map, or they'll accept a map that was considered during the legislative process.
I've got a historical question that you probably know something about. What happened to reapportionment and redistricting after the 1920 census?
Ah, yes. So we did go through a round of apportionment. This is the allocation of congressional districts to the states. And I believe it was 1920. I could be wrong on that. But the Congress could not come to an agreement on the apportionment formula, and so they left the apportionment in the number of seats allocated to the districts, to the states, the same. And that caused imbalances in populations between districts. And so that's the only time that they didn't do an apportionment from the congressional districts among the states.
The reason I ask is I just read Daniel Ockrent's book, Last Call. It's a history of prohibition. And the reason Congress didn't do that was because the pro-prohibition people didn't want over-representation or new representation from the urban areas. They didn't want to lose the pro-prohibition majority in the House. So they delayed it until 1932.
Yes, well, it's why many states, for the redistricting now, not their apportionment, didn't do a redistricting for 60 or more years. The case Baker v. Carr, which started the reapportionment revolution and this redistricting following each census, was really based on a Tennessee state legislative districts that hadn't been drawn since 1900.
Wow.
Yeah. And so they'd become way out of balance. I think the ratio was 60 to 1 was the size of the largest district to the smallest district. And that wasn't even the worst. That wasn't even the worst state. The worst state was a state like Connecticut, which had apportioned one district to every township. And there you had a ratio of several thousand people to several thousand to one.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, just one last question. Can you describe sort of what you do as a consultant to people who are doing redistricting?
There are a number of different functions. One is helping jurisdictions produce redistricting plans that are in conformance with federal and state criteria, and so I've done that in my history of being a consultant. I've drawn districts in my history of consultant, and I've also been involved in litigation where either defending or either as a defendant or a plaintiff coming in and defending or challenging whether or not a districting plan is legal.
I come from Charlottesville, where we elect city council and school board at large rather than in districts. What's sort of the state of at large, you know, litigation against at large elections, and then where are we on that?
Recently, the Department of Justice has looked at remedies to voting rights violations. They have looked to multi-member districts as a solution to violations of voting rights. That's only been in a limited number of cases, and there are a number of issues that are at play there. So I don't know if that's really going to be a door to open to say that we're going to have multi-member districts everywhere. There's another group called the Center for Voting and Democracy that's located at IDC, and they are the primary advocates for doing an alternative electoral system in the United States. That's Rob Ritchie's. There they've had some limited success at adopting some sort of multi-member and now you have to be careful because what they really want to do is proportional representation, which is a little bit different than saying have a multi-member district where, say, four people run at large and they each run in a separate election at large. What they're really talking about is if there are four representatives and somebody gets 25% of the vote, then they get a seat. All right, so it's proportional representation versus this sort of at-large sort of system. It's also what the sort of cumulative voting and alternative vote and these other schemes or methods. I don't want to call them schemes because it sounds
like in Cambridge and Berkeley.
They have been adopted, as I said, for voting rights concerns. There's been some limited adoption in some states, localities. But as far as the state level goes, there's not been a lot of success. So what they're really looking at is trying to build up support from the grassroots up. There's a lot of resistance because the major political parties see this as potentially taking away some of their power. And so they have opposed, both Democrats and Republicans have banded together to oppose an initiative, say, on the ballot in Alaska that would have created multi-member districts with a sort of proportional representation for the state of Alaska. So you find a lot of resistance within the political system from the major parties for this. And so I think it's going to be a long time before we see some states actually adopt or even the Congress allow, because right now you have to have single-member congressional districts. It's part of federal law to have any sort of multi-member districts.
There was one other Virginia-related case before the U.S. Supreme Court this week. The justices ruled that Virginia's law against uranium mining was constitutional and could continue to be enforced. Earlier this year, at the Conservative Political Action Conference, I met Scott Melby, the Executive Vice President of the Uranium Energy Corporation. He was at CPAC to promote uranium mining in the United States, which, he argues, would have benefits both for energy users and for national security. I also asked him to comment on Virginia's law.
Where will new deposits of uranium in the United States come from?
Yeah, so the main areas, the largest deposits that are being mined and will be mined are out in the western United States in Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, Arizona, Nebraska, and Texas. There's a number of plants in that have been constructed or are in development that can meet this increased demand. There's also a deposit in your state of Virginia, which hasn't been developed, but we don't lack resources in the United States, and we can mine using very environmentally friendly technologies like the in-situ recovery method, which allows us to go mine deposits in sandstone-hosted formations that can be done with minimal impact on the environment. So much potential.
You mentioned Virginia, which has a legal moratorium on uranium mining, I think, for the past 40 years.
Right.
Are there other states with those kinds of legal obstacles?
I think Virginia is extreme in that regard. We generally we're regulated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission with some input from the EPA. But more and more states are becoming what's known as agreement states. Wyoming and Texas are two such examples where they regulate uranium mining to the federal standard, but it's managed out of their state regulatory body. So they're more responsive. Nobody has a greater vested interest than the state itself. And so we find that states that have gone to that model are it's not easy to license a new mine, and it shouldn't be easy. We should have to meet all the most stringent environmental standards, and we do. But we find that agreement state structure is very positive. High regulatory standards, but administered at the state level.
Do you foresee it becoming easier to build nuclear power plants in the next few years?
Yeah, it's interesting, and there's been a lot of there was one perhaps one of the only benefits of the Green New Deal, which was a little short on science and economics behind some of the things proposed there. But we are seeing a renewed discussion and acceptance of nuclear power from, of all places, the climate change community, where they've been doing this now for 24 years and have seen very little progress on carbon emissions reductions. And they're now kind of coming to this realization: if we are going to make any impact, not not only in countries like Germany that have been trying for 24 years and not succeeding. What about countries like India and China that are emerging markets and, you know, they've got to deliver electricity in a way that doesn't harm the environment, the clean air, and forget about, you know, climate change, just pollution issues in those countries are first and foremost. So it is a very exciting time for nuclear. We've added 37 reactors in the last 5 years, 50 more in construction.
That's all the time we have this week on The Score. For all the editors and writers at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to come back next week for more news, reviews, and interviews. We'll be looking for you.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.